Here is a special announcement. Today is Tuesday, and not, as is announced in today's Sunday Telegraph, Friday. And now, a repeat of last Thursday's performance of Monday Night is Music Night.
Thanks, as always, to Kipper the Cat and his team, and, of course, to the cold germs that Greg's left behind, but we've taken precautions, and I think that won't spread. We thank, too, the people who give us those brief news snippets, bringing the world simplistically to our ears as we now slip into our seats for this week's Evening Under Lamplight with your host, me, Robert Louis Abrahamson, of course, on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city. You can reach us at lamplight@cambridge105.co.uk with comments and questions and even requests. And you can be sure of an answer, too. That's because you're not only invited to attend, but invited to respond. What is a voice on radio or elsewhere? What is a voice without a response? As you know, we're following Dante as he descends deeper and deeper into the Inferno, a mythic journey that everyone knows something about, but few people have ever really learned, or better yet, experienced, what this literary journey is really like, both for Dante and for us, his readers. That's why I decided to introduce Dante like this on our show. And this evening, under lamplight, we come to an odd incident on Dante's journey. He comes to the area of the barraters, or grafters, the people guilty of public corruption. Dante thought that this sin was so widespread and pernicious that he stretches this episode over three cantos. It's the longest single episode in the Inferno. But it's something else, too. It provides a kind of comic interval in the Inferno before we get down to the really horrible stuff. There are the stereotyped demons with pitchforks and bat-like wings, and there are hijinks of various kinds, lots of trickery and double-crossing and stupid blundering. And here's what I plan to do. First, I'd like to say a few things about barratry, or public corruption. We don't need to spend too much time on this because we all know what this is all about, alas. And after that general discussion, we'll spend the rest of the show as a kind of story time as I try to run us through the events of this episode. And we'll see what kind of music I can find to intersperse with the narration. Okay, let's get started. Barratry is the act of buying and selling public office, the secular equivalent of simony, you remember simony, the buying and selling of church office. Corruption is, at least in many cultures, a crime, but it is also, as Dante shows us, a sin. It is an offence against the holy order of the world. Why? Because, like all other sins in Dante's vision, it destroys community. As Dorothy Sayers says, barriers make profit out of the trust reposed in them by the community, and what they sell is justice. That's an unusual way of putting it, and that's good. What's the point of reading all this stuff if it doesn't present us with unusual ways of looking at and understanding our world? Perhaps we've become so used to buying and selling of public office that we have forgotten to think about public trust or even about justice. When we have governments that push on with their own agenda, aiming to promote the interests of the few, it seems that the trust people place in government has become irrelevant. And as for justice, it often seems like a cover word for political opportunism. What sort of things exactly are we talking about with barratry? Well, suppose you own a hotel and then gain high office for yourself, and then when official visitors come to town, you book them into your hotel, and thus using your political office to feed your own pockets. Or having a high position in government, gaining you lots of inside information and influence, then you let a newspaper buy you and your influence. Or you control a large corporation or are head of an enemy country and pay lots of money, millions of pounds or dollars, let's say, to support some politician's political campaign. Is that justice? Is that promoting the trust the community should have in its leaders? I was thinking that The Godfather is not an example of barratry because his kind of corruption does not involve public office. It's just extortion and black marketeering and things like that. But then I remembered that Don Corleone's real power comes from his having the police and many local and national politicians on his payroll. This, of course, is barratry. Now, one reason why Dante spends so much time on this particular sin is that it had a very personal meaning for him. When he was exiled from Florence, it was because he was charged with barratry for misusing money while he held public office in the city. As we'll see, this is the region of the Inferno where Dante faces more personal danger and is personally threatened more alarmingly than anywhere else. He's telling us something here. And of course, Dante's world knew public corruption probably more than anywhere in our world today, or perhaps people like Dante have made us more aware of it. We all live in a political world where, as Dylan says, love don't have any place. We're living in times when men commit crimes and crimes don't have a face. Attend.
We're living in times when men commit crimes and crime don't have a face. We live in a political world, icicles hanging down, wedding bells ringing, angels singing, clouds cover up the ground. We live in a political world, wisdom is thrown into jail. It rots in a cell misguided as hell, leaving no one to pick up the trail. We live in a political world where mercy walks the plank. Life is in mirrors, death disappears up the steps of you, the nearest bay. Children are unwanted, your next day could be your last. We live in a sure that it's real. We live in a political world, the cities of a lonesome fear. Little by little, you turn to the middle, but you're never sure why you're here.
Well, we live in a political world. That was Dylan's Political World from the 1989 album Oh Mercy. One of his best albums, I've always thought, though I don't think everyone agrees. But the song is a succession of 11 quatrains, or four-line stanzas, each beginning, "We live in a political world," and then describing another aspect of the moral collapse, with the third line dancing with internal rhyme. Dylan's not presenting a new idea, of course. The song's strength comes instead from its dark, nervous energy, not its specific message. Maybe people don't want to be reminded of all this corruption going on, but that's tough. We've committed ourselves to descending with Dante, and we can't turn away now. And so these barriers, condemned in hell to lie submerged beneath a pool of boiling, sticky pitch. Why is this? Well, for one thing, as one of the demons points out, these guys have carried out their underhand shenanigans undercover, and now they must enact this undercover business literally, but being kept under the surface of this pitch. But it's also appropriate because the crime of bribery and payoffs is a sticky business. Once you start taking or giving bribes and engaging in other kinds of civic fraud, you can't get out. It sticks to you and will be exposed to public view sooner or later. You're never free to be a person with your own free will. You're watching this sort of stickiness take place right now in Washington as all these crooked politicians and their cronies are finding their money laundering and bribery getting closer and closer to being exposed. They know they cannot wash the sticky tar off themselves, but their tarry skin will be revealed clearly sooner or later. Well, I think that's all I have to say for the moment about barratry in general. Let's call in again Bobby Chen with Mussorgsky's Promenade to lead us into the next section, when we'll get the story of what actually is going on down there with Dante, Virgil, the barriers, and their tormentors. It's a superb part of the Inferno, with perhaps the most vivid images of sadism and torture combined with comic trickery and obscenity. And so Dante and Virgil journey on. They've left the circular ditch of the Thron, or twisted sorcerers, and they've come to the next ditch, chatting together as they walk. What are they chatting about? Oh, just things, che la mia commedia cantar non cura, things my divine comedy does not care to sing. Okay, none of our business then. It's a bit of a tease, isn't it? But Dante just wants to remind us that he's not telling us everything, only those things necessary for us to know. We all do this, all the time, with each other. Dante is now halfway across the bridge over this next ditch, and looks down to see what's there, eager to find out what enlightening contortions of the human spirit are coming up next. He looks, but sees nothing going on. No action, no people. All he can see is mirabilmente oscura, astonishing darkness. Well, not quite entire darkness. He can make out something like pitch or tar slowly bubbling up, the surface swelling up and then bursting and settling back again. And this image reminds him of something he'd seen elsewhere. in the shipyards of Venice, in fact, where, in winter, when they cannot venture out on the stormy waters, the sailors boil up the thick pitch in huge vats to caulk up the holes of their ships, while other people rebuild damaged parts of the ship, or make new oars, or twist new rope for rigging. We get a prolonged image of this active shipyard, where people are making the best of an off-season to carry out constructive work, a community of workers, cooperating together for the common good. This good and useful work in the opening image, of course, is going to contrast with the corrupted officials we're about to see, whose abuse of power hinders any kind of good work, turning all into opportunities to line their own pockets, and who, far from cooperating, turn on each other at any moment. Everyone, after all, has some kind of honest work to do, like those Venetian laborers. Okay, now let me here make a jump from Dante to another favorite of mine, Fraggle Rock, a kids' show from the 80s that I hope you're acquainted with. We know that on Fraggle Rock, the doozers work all the time. That's how they fulfill their innermost nature. But even the Fraggles, whose inner nature just craves fun, even they have work to do. They have certain duties that must be done. There's ping-pong games that must be played and songs that must be sung. Or they have to dive into the pool and swim around a lot to keep the water clean. And then there's poor Boober, the nebuch, or nerd, who loves, as he tells us, work that's boring, boring to the core, a job that goes on much too long and then goes on some more. You can hear more about this in one of the liveliest of the Fraggle songs, simply called Workin'. Attend to the saxophone, which is working pretty hard here. Now, the song begins after the intro with the word workin' repeated 16 times. Work at it, kids.
Get yourself to work. Fraggles never fool around. Fraggles never shirk. Your duty's always waiting.
Duty must be done. There's ping pong games that must be played and songs that must be sung.
Working, 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 working.
I'd like to tell the story of what my work is for. A tale of toil and gathering and radishes and more. But don't forget my mighty job, the lonely tough routine. I dive and crash and swim and splash to keep the water clean.
Working, 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 working,
sure.
It was a song called Working, as you know, one of the songs from Fraggle Rock, a wonderfully complex, compassionate series of dramas by Jim Henson and his crew, and a cast comprised of a variety of colourful and jaunty puppets. Not quite as witty as the Muppets, but a fine example of how you can be really tender without becoming sentimental. And the music is always just wonderful. Here, while we're there, take another song while we're stopped. This is called Muck and Goo. It's basically a child's counting game, 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on, but done the way a child likes it, full of dirt and disgusting things that adults don't allow, but kids love. It's a test, in a way, to see whether you've lost that childlike part of yourself. And also, I figured this muck and goo is a fitting way to get moving into the region of sticky pitch Dante is staring down at.
Give me one and give me two. Cover me with muck and goo.
Give me three and give me four. Cover me with guck and gore. One, two, muck and goo. Down my sock and in my shoe. Three, four, guck and gore. Spin me round and sing some more.
Whoa!
Give me five and give me six. Cover me with big fat sticks. Give me seven, give me eight. Cover me with slime and slate.
Six, fat sticks, an ice cream cone for me to lick. Seven, eight, slime and slate. Sing it now and don't be late.
Give me number nine. A bag of bones in a ball of twine.
Give me number ten. Run back home and start again.
Nine, a ball of twine. First it's yours and then it's mine. Ten, that's the end. So run back home and start again. Run back home and start again.
There we go, back-to-back Fraggle songs. And now, back to the muck and goo of this fifth bolgia, or ditch, in the eighth circle of the Inferno. We left Dante staring down into the pitch-dark bottom of the ditch, but suddenly, Virgil cries out, Guarda, guarda, look out, look out! And he pulls Dante away from the edge of the bridge. But as is natural, even as Dante is pulled away by Virgil, he turns back to see what it is that has so alarmed his leader. And there, along the edge of the ditch, he sees through the gloom a diavolo nero, a dark devil, racing towards them, his face contorted in a ferocious grimace, his arms threatening, his feet rushing, and his wings, yes, winged devils here, his wings stretched out to their full extent as he runs. This is the only time in the Inferno that we come across the popular figure of devils, known from medieval plays and festivals, and it adds somehow to the raucousness of the ensuing drama. This figure is frightful, but as it turns out, he's not running after Dante. He's actually doing his work here. Dante notices that he's carrying over his high and pointed shoulders, as one might carry the carcass of an animal into the butcher's back room, he's carrying a sinner hooked by the tendons on his heels. The devil calls out to his fellow workers down there, "Hey, guys, here's another one of those grafters from Lucca where everyone's on the take. Dunk him into the pitch while I go back and get some more." Apparently this guy's just died and been dumped down to this level, and now he's being thrown into his place, dunked under this boiling pitch. And so this sinner is thrown into the pitch, where he sinks and then rises up again, his face covered with pitch. "Yo," the demons shouted him from under the bridge. "Yo, you're not back at the public swimming pools. Get all the way under the pitch." And then they attack him with more than 100 hooks, ripping him and taunting him further. "You always did your underhand deals in the dark up there. Now you have to do them under cover of this black pitch, if you can." And here Dante gives us one of his most famous images. The demons push this sinner down under the pitch, just as chefs tell their assistants to take their forks and prod the meat down into the cauldron for a stew so that it doesn't float to the top and get only partially cooked. You can see how this episode seems to combine the gruesome with the comic.
You might lose your lover, as people do sometimes. Oh, but it won't make sense to you to sit around crying. Son, don't you know that when you fall in love, sometimes you're gonna have the blues. Now, well, it may take years, but you're gonna shed some tears, 'cause everybody's got to face some dues. You might have money, yeah, and a big fine car. It don't matter what you look like. No, it don't matter who you are. Son, don't you know you can't win all the time? Sometimes you're gonna have to lose. Just as long as you live, you got to take as well as give, 'cause everybody's got to pay some dues. Everybody's got to pay some dues.
That was, I think you would have recognized, that was The Miracles. Everybody's got to pay some dues. Why that song? Well, these grafters had it good up in the living world, but they always had some dues to pay for all their corruption, and now they got to pay those dues. Well, it may take years, Smokey says, but you're going to shed some tears. And, well, you might have money and a big fine car. It doesn't matter what your friends are like. It don't matter who you are. Son, don't you know you can't win all the time? Sometime you're going to have to lose. Well, just as long as you live, you have to take as well as give. I think he means you got to give as well as take, but Smokey ignores meaning when he has a rhyme to get out there. You got to take as well as give, 'cause everybody's got to pay some dues. But there's another reason why this song might fit here. The other day, it's a silly reason, but let me go on. The other day we played Money from the first Miracles album, and this song comes from their second album, released in the same year, 1961, now with a more elaborate backup. Notice all those strings. The album was called, for some reason, Cookin' with the Miracles. Cookin' with an apostrophe, no, not cooking. And the group on the cover all stood around in a circle wearing dinner jackets, tuxedos. Smokey wearing a chef's hat. All the guys holding a mixing bowl in one hand and a wooden mixing spoon in the other, except Marv Taplin, who proudly exhibits his guitar. And Claudette, in a long red dress, holding an empty casserole dish in one hand and the lid of the dish in the other. See, cooking with the miracles. You bet. Motown still hadn't got the knack of coming up with tasteful record covers. But there they were, ready to prod down pieces of meat into the stew like those devils prodding the barriters into the pitch. A bit far-fetched, but remember, this is the comic episode, so I have some leeway, haven't I? Now, back to the story. Where all the attention is focused on that new grafter being cooked in the pitch. But Virgil is alert and tells Dante to take cover behind a rock so that those devils don't catch sight of him. He's not worried about himself, though. Virgil says he's been here before and seen the same things going on, and he came away perfectly safe. So he confidently crosses the bridge and goes up to the devils there, who all swarm out from under the bridge and threaten to spear Virgil too and throw him into the pitch. But Virgil stands his ground and demands to speak to one of them about his divine protection for this journey. All the devils cry out that Malacoda should be the one to speak. But wait, let's spend a minute on the names of these devils, or Malbranche, evil claws. They have very colorful names in Italian, with gruesome or comic meanings, which translators are never sure about translating. Before we go on, let me give you a wee catalogue of these demons we'll be dealing with. The leader is Malacoda, evil tail. And there are Alecchino, Calcabrina, Cagnazzo, Barbariccia, Libicocco, Dragignazzo, Ciriatto, Graffiacane, Farfarello, and Rubicante. Nice catalogue of names. So it's Malacoda, evil tail, whom Virgil speaks to. Don't you realize that I could have come this far into hell only through divine sanction, he says? It's divine will that directs us here, so harm us at your peril. Well, this deflates Malacoda, or seems to deflate him. We're in the region of fraud and deceit. We can't take anything at face value. And he drops the point of his weapon and tells the others to leave Virgil alone. Okay, Virgil calls out to Dante. It's safe for you to come out now. Virgil, too, you see, has been deceitful, keeping Malacoda unaware that he's accompanied by a living person. Now you can imagine how quickly Dante runs over to Virgil with all those devils rushing forward to get him, even though they've been told to leave him alone. It was like, Dante tells us, it was like the time he was at the siege of Caprona, and the troops came out of the town on safe conduct, but had to pass through all the ranks of the enemy soldiers, afraid that the safe conduct would not hold. Dante clings to Virgil for protection, scared out of his mind by those gruesome figures giving him hungry looks. Hey, how about if I just nick him a little on the behind, says one. Yes, yeah, says another, why not? Give him something to remember us by. But Malacoda stops them. Leave it, you two. And he turns to Virgil with what appears to be some friendly, sincere advice. Look, you can't cross over this bridge here, he tells them. It fell apart 1,266 years ago, minus 5 hours. That is when, in the Easter story, Jesus descended into hell between Good Friday and Easter Sunday. So, he continues, you'll have to move on further along here to the next set of bridges, which are still standing. I'm sending some of my men out that way, as a matter of fact, to check that none of those sinners are peeping out of the pitch. They'll take you along with them. Go with them. They won't hurt you. And so Malacoda gathers his task force to go along with Dante and Virgil. But, you know, Dante whispers to Virgil, I'm not so sure this is such a good idea. Do we have to go with them? Can't we just go along, just the two of us? Look at the way they're grinding their teeth and looking at us as though ready to do us harm. We can't trust them one inch. But Virgil has more faith, or more gullibility. Don't be afraid, they're just looking fierce because they have to look that way for all those sinners in the pitch. Not for us. And so they set off. But in good military fashion, there's an exchange between the party going off on a mission and the commander back at the camp. It's usually done with trumpets and drums, of course, but here it's different. The troops make a farting noise with their tongue and teeth, and Malacoda, as Dante puts it, avia del cul fatto trombetta. The one line every Italian schoolboy remembers from studying this poem in school. He made a trumpet of his arse. Oh, that was Clark Terry's Trumpet Mouthpiece Blues, using just the mouthpiece, not the whole trumpet, as Clark Terry sometimes did in performance. Not quite the kind of arse trumpet Malacoda was performing on, but all the better. I wouldn't play you a track of fart music, even if I had one in my collection. Well, we've come to the end of Canto 21. This episode is not over yet, and we'll continue with it right after reminding you that you're listening to Evening Under Lamplight with your host, Robert Louis Abrahamson, on Cambridge 105. And we're following Dante this evening in the area of the barraters, or grafters, corrupt public officials. So far, we've made no specific allusions to any modern-day corrupt officials, but you never know. And here's someone who may be shady, but never corrupt.
When the day comes to an end, he invites you to attend Evening Under Lamplight. It's Cambridge 105. Community radio in your city.
So, we left Dante and Virgil being escorted along the edge of the ditch of the grafters, over to the next bridge across the ditches, since the one they intended to use had been shattered at Christ's descent into hell on Easter Saturday. Malacoda has assured them that they'll be able to cross at the next bridge, and also that his troop of 10 devils will not harm them. This is not the company they would have chosen, but as Dante says in the beginning of Canto 22, shrugging his shoulders, Nella chiesa coi santi, e in taverna coi ghiattoni, in church with saints, in the tavern with guzzlers. As they go along, Dante has his eyes fixed on the pitch. He's here, after all, to observe these various lessons about human sinfulness. And what does he see? Well, like dolphins arching their backs above the water, or like frogs squatting at the edge of some pond with just their nose out of the water, so these sinners occasionally lift parts of themselves out of the pitch, just for a few seconds of relief, hoping that the devils don't spot them. But as soon as the troop of devils comes near, they all plunge back into the boiling pitch. Uh-oh. Unfortunately, one of these sinners hasn't been quick enough to get back under cover, and the devil, Graffiacane, spears him with his billhook and fishes him out, sleek with pitchy goo, looking like an otter. The other demons are having a great time, with all the delight of a gang of bullies having some fresh victim to play with. Go to it, Rubicante, they shout. Rip his skin off. In the midst of this nasty uproar, Dante asks Virgil if he can find out who that poor guy might be. And Virgil goes up close and, presumably while the guy's being ripped up, has the chutzpah to ask him where he came from. Well, he comes from Navarre. He doesn't tell us his name, but later commentators suggest this man is Ciampolo, though we know nothing more about him than what he tells Virgil, which isn't much. His father wasted all their money, and so he had to go into service with a nobleman, and then served King Thibault II of Navarre. Quivi mi missia far barateria. There first I set myself to taking bribes, he says. At this point, he has to stop, since Ciriato, who has two tusks growing up on either side of his jaw, shows his skill in tuskery and gives Ciampolo a vicious rip. But Barbariccia, the leader, stops any further violence from the others. He wants to have a jab himself, and that's the way with cheaters always. They can't get any job properly done because they can't work together, but only for themselves. Before Barbariccia enjoys his torture, though, he pauses to let Virgil ask anything else he might want to know. And that's another form of torture, after all, holding the victim in suspense, knowing there's worse to come in a few minutes. And what important question does Virgil ask? Are there any Italians among these sinners here? He could have guessed that there would be many, but this is just a lead-on question, I suppose. And as Ciampolo begins to answer that there's one Italian he was just hiding out with, Libicocco interrupts. He can't hold himself back any longer, and with his weapon he gouges out a hunk of flesh from Ciampolo's arm. And Drag Ignazio makes a grab at his legs, maybe to rip one of them off, we don't know, because the captain stops them. Ciampolo is in something of a state of shock, as we can imagine. That is, if these shades of dead souls can suffer shock. He's staring down at the hole in his arm, and Virgil asks about this one Italian he'd mentioned. And Ciampolo begins a catalogue of various Italian grafters stationed in this area. But the demons are getting restless. But look, I'll tell you what I'll do, says Ciampolo, who's apparently been reading The Art of the Deal. If you're that anxious to learn about these other Italians here, well, why don't I contrive to get them to show their faces? And that way, you can ask them yourself. I can give them the signal that all's clear, and they'll pop up out of the pitch. Hey, and all you demons, though, you're going to have to get out of sight so you don't frighten them off. In other words, he promises to lie to his friends in order to please his enemies, the devils. But in fact, he's lying to the devils in order to protect himself. Now, the thing about these self-seeking fraudsters is, as we've said, that they're always out for themselves, and you can never trust them. Oh, sure, says Cagnazzo then. Listen to this slippery guy. As soon as we back off, he'll just jump right back into the pitch. No, look, look, you have to hide or there's no deal. Do you think I'd cause my friends greater harm? The demons are suspicious, but one of them, Alecchino, announces that, all right, he's willing to go along with Ciampolo's trick, and he promises not to go after Ciampolo and persuades all the others to follow him and hide. Ciampolo, of course, the minute he sees the demons go off, sets his feet in position and dives back into the pitch, suffering the boiling stickiness in preference to their vicious blades and tusks. And that's how grafters work. They'll make a deal with you, playing on your desire to get what you want, and then they'll turn and leave you empty-handed. They are corrupt, but they're also backstabbers. What do? They smile in your face. The backstabbers. Blades are long, clenched tight in their fist, aiming straight at your back, and I don't think they'll miss. What can I do to get back on the right track? I wish they'd take some of these knives out of my back. I don't need no low-down, dirty bastards. That's right. It's the Philadelphia sound of the OJs and Backstabbers here on the Voice of Philadelphia Chauvinism in Cambridge. The song's actually about his anguish at the way even his best friends are trying to move in on his girlfriend, and the knives in his back are only metaphors. But this is a good place to bring in the song, as Ciampolo does some backstabbing himself, promising to stab his own friends down there in the back, but metaphorically stabbing the demons in the back after they've been literally stabbing and ripping him all over his body. So Ciampolo has outwitted the demons and made it safe back into the pitch. Out of the fire, into the frying pan, we might say. But that's not the end of the story. Alecchino, the one who believed Ciampolo, is now furious, and spreading his wings, he takes off after the grafter, but can't get to him before he plunges to safety. Calcabrina, one of the other demons, is even more furious, not at Ciampolo, but at Alecchino, whose gullibility lost them their fun. And as I said earlier, corrupt people will leave their enemy and turn on each other whenever they can. And so Calcabrina flies after Alecchino, catching up to him right over the boiling pitch. They scuffle for a minute or two, but then tumble, both of them, right into the scalding pitch. It has all come to a sorry end, and the other demons have to stretch out their hooks to haul the two demons out of there, since their wings are all glued up, and even after the short immersion, they were already cotti dentro dalla crosta, cooked to a crust. Well, now we've moved into Canto 23, and we see Dante and Virgil escaping less raucously than this. Taciti, soli, senza compagnia, silent, alone, without company, they sneak away one behind the other. Virgil, you remember, has trusted Barbariccia's promise that they'll come to no harm as they go along their way, but Dante has mistrusted all the time. And as he walks, he does some impressive psychological figuring. He says to himself, "You know, those devils have been cheated because of us. They would have had their enjoyment in torturing Ciampolo if we hadn't stopped their game to ask questions. This is going to make them really angry at us, and that anger, added to the malice they already felt, is surely going to make them rush after us as soon as they notice we're gone." And he prods Virgil. Can't we go a little faster and find somewhere to hide? I'm terrified. I can feel them coming up behind us. I think I can even hear them coming. And at this moment of their greatest danger, when swift action is called for, Virgil, more comedy, takes 9 lines to say, "Yes, I agree, let's hide." But before Virgil can finish, they catch sight of these demons flying towards them, wings spread wide. Virgil can move swiftly when he has to, and like a mother in the night who hears people crying fire and snatches up her baby and rushes out of the burning house without even thinking to put on any clothes, so Virgil grabs Dante, and together they slide down the bank into the next ditch. Fortunately, this ditch isn't filled with boiling pitch like the previous ditch, or with a pool of shit like the one earlier. And just in time, because they look up and see the devils on the edge of the ditch, leering down at them. But they are safe. These functionaries in hell cannot move out of their appointed places. They're stuck inside of the fifth bulge, while those with a divine passport can move on to experience what's coming next. And we too now move on, this evening's show having come to an end. But we'll be back again in a fortnight when we discover what strange new ditch of fraud Dante and Virgil have landed themselves in this time. Hey, thanks for being here with us this evening under lamplight, and be sure to join us again on Cambridge 105 when your host, that's me, Robert Louis Abrahamson, brings you another evening under lamplight. And to go out with, well, we couldn't attend to Barratry without bringing in the Kinks' Money and Corruption, the people's protest against public corruption. This is from the Kinks' album Preservation, Act 1.
got sick and tired of being promised this and that. We work all day, we sweat and we slave to keep the wealthy fat. They fill our heads with promises and bamboozle us with facts. Then they pull off false sincerity, then they laugh behind our backs. Money and corruption are ruining the land. Crooked politicians betray the working man. Pocket in their profits and treating us like sheep. We're tired of hearing promises we know they'll never keep. Money and corruption ruining the land. Crooked politicians betray the working man. Pocket in their profits and treating us like sheep. We're tired of hearing promises we